is Parshas Toldos, where we know it's the birth of the two children of Yitzchak and Rivka, the twins, both Yaakov and Esav. And we know that when the children are born, as verse 2 tells us, the first one emerged red, entirely like a hairy mantle, so they named him Esav. And after that, his brother emerged with his hand grasping onto the heel of Esav, so he called his name Yaakov. And we know that Yitzchak was 6 years old when she bore them. When we're looking at this story of the birth of Yaakov and Esav, and the Parsha then goes through some of the incidences that happened in Yitzchak Avinu's life by Plishtim, and it ends ultimately with Esav wanting the brachas, was supposed to be getting the brachas, and how Yaakov dressed up and was able to get the brachos before Esav, and the disappointment and the bitterness that Esav felt toward him, that ultimately Yaakov has to run away to save his life. When we look at the personality of Esav, which is what I want to focus in on Amir Tzashem today, we all have certain ideas that conjure up in our mind, and many of them are ideas that we've learned in different parts in our life. And the Chovos Levavos always says, and it's an important Chovos Levavos to remember, that when we learn a pasuk in Chumash, we have to look at it as if we've never seen it before. Because when we look at it as children, how can you compare as when we look at it as an adult? And even as adults, we grow, we mature, we look at things differently. There's a lot to say about Esav, and clearly I'm not going to be able to cover the expanse of Esav and its greatness. We're not even going to get into the whole Kibud Av Va'Em, the way he dressed up special to serve his father, and the greatness that Esav had in this mitzvah, not even getting into all of that. I'd like to try to paint the personality of Esav, that we get a sense of how Esav becomes for us a model as well. The Sfarim HaKadoshim tell us that every single incident in the Torah, every single personality is meant for us to learn from. So I think it behooves us to see what can we learn from Esav. What models does Esav have for our individual lives? The one story that I'd like to focus in on primarily today, and we're going to see really three different levels of Esav's personality, is the story beginning in verse 27, continuing in source 2, where the lads grew up and Esav became one who knows hunting, a man of the field. But Yaakov's an ishtam yoshevo alim, a wholesome man abiding in tents. Yitzchak loved Esav, ki tzayid befiv, for game was in his mouth. But Rivka loved Yaakov. And again, there's a lot to say about this. We'll touch on it, perhaps. And Yaakov, and obviously we can't get to everything. And that's the beauty of learning. It's year after year, Amir Tzashem, my friend. Yaakov simmered a stew, and Esav came in from the field, and he was exhausted. And Esav said to Yaakov, Haliteini na mina adoma adomazeh, pour into me, I'll open my mouth, and you just pour down some of this very red stuff, for I am exhausted. Valken karashmo Edom, he therefore called his name Edom. And Yaakov said, hold on a second, before I give you this nesid adashim, this lentils, sell as this day your birthright to me. And Esav said, look, I'm going to die. So what use to me is a birthright? And he makes him swear, and he swears, and he sells him the birthright. And the pasuk says that he ate, he got up, he ate, and vayivez Esav etibachor, and he despised this birthright. Obviously, this story also has a tremendous amount in it that we need to examine, and I think within this story, we will come up with three components about the life of Esav, and particularly for our study, how it applies to our lives. As the point of departure, I'd like to look at a fantastic insight of Rav Gedalia Shur in the Or Gedaliahu, where he notes in Source 3, Yiduim Adrim Shavot Ba'u L'Taken Cheto Shel Adam HaRishon. We know the forefathers' jobs primarily was to rectify and fix the original sin of Adam HaRishon. This job of fixing the sin which Avraham Avinu began and Yitzchak Avinu began was given equally to Yaakov and Esav. And the Shlach Kadosh notes that this is why they were Te'umim, they were twins. Because just like we had two trees in the Garden of Eden, we had the Eitz HaChayim, the tree of life, and the Eitz HaDat Tov HaRa, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, we have two children that model these two trees. The Yitzchayim, the tree of life, is Yaakov Avinu, the Ishtam, the perfect one, the one who sits in dwellings and tent, the one who represents the Aseto, the ability to be involved in the positive. But then we have the tree of the Eitz Hadaat Tov V'Ra. And we know in source form that this tree of Eitz Hadaat Tov V'Ra before Adam ate from the tree meant that there was evil only external to Adam HaRishon. But once he ate from the tree, that struggle of good and evil became part and parcel of who he was. And the struggle that Adam had, and now the struggle we all have, is to be able to have the good conquer and vanquish the bad. Originally, when Adam HaRishon, after he ate of this tree, originally he was on a level of perfection. When he fell, the job now of Esav was to be metaken, he was to rectify this aspect of the fall. It's like Yaakov Avinu is Adam HaRishon before he sinned, and Esav is Adam HaRishon after the sin. This explains Ve'ela Toldos Yitzchak, where the beginning of our parasha says these are the Toldos, the children of Yitzchak. And Rashi explains these are Yaakov and Esav who are mentioned in our parasha. And the Farshim asks the obvious question in source number 5. V'chi mi eino yodea she'elu heim toldotav shel Yitzchak? Uma ba Rashi lashmein v'zeh? Duh, look at the next couple of psukim. You know that the children of Yitzchak are Yaakov and Esav. What is Rashi telling us by saying, Eilu told us Yitzchak, these are the children, the descendants of Yitzchak, Yaakov and Esav. It's known. But Rashi is teaching us something very deep here. Rashi is telling us that both of them, in the ideal world, were supposed to be the descendants of Yitzchak. Both of these were supposed to be the children of Yitzchak. Both of these were supposed to carry on the line. It wasn't supposed to be Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, but rather there was a potential for Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Esav. And had Esav met the challenge, had Esav been able to overcome the negative, he too would have been part of Klal Yisrael, and they would have worked together to be metaken in this sin of Adam HaRishon. This was supposed to be the ideal world where Yaakov and Esav would have worked together. And this is what Rav Gedalia Shur notes in source number 6. Esav, Afshayabo Harbei Ra. Esav, who although had a lot of evil, as we know that when he was in his mother's womb, he tried to go out, when it was by the Batei Avodah Zarah, by the place of the idol worship. Hayambo Gamke Nitzot Shel Tov. He also had a lot of goodness. Keep in mind, he was the child of Yitzchak and Rivka, the grandchild of Avraham Avinu and Sarah Imenu. V'atafkid Shel Esav Hayah L'taken Chatol Shel Adam HaRishon. His job was to fix the sin of Adam HaRishon. L'taken HaTarovet Shel Hara B'Tov Shenaseh Yidei Achilat Adam HaRishon Eitz Hadaat. To fix this mixture of good and evil that was the result of the sin of Adam HaRishon. And that's why, since his job was to fix the damage that Adam HaRishon did, he had a mixture within him of Tov V'Ra. And his job was Lahachnia et Hara Shebo. Esav was a very holy person. Esav had a very holy mission. His mission, and if he was successful, he would have been great, was to be able to fix where Adam HaRishon messed up, to take the negative within him and to elevate it to the good. And we see that Esav had goodness in him. We see this in source 8. That when Yaakov Avinu takes the brachos from Esav, Esav cries a loud and bitter cry. He sheds tears that we are suffering for until today. He understood what bracha is. He understood what it meant to lose out on the blessing of Yitzchak. He understood what his greatness was about. He understood what the whole aspect of Yitzchak Avinu is about. Esav was a tremendous person. He was a great person. And this was his koach. And in fact, when Yitzchak blesses Esav that he should be subordinate to Yaakov, that's this bracha. That if you can be subordinate to good, you will achieve greatness. This is your ticket. This is your secret in life. What happened? Where was the falling of Esav? So the key, my friends, for the level number 1 is the asterisk in source number 6 based on the Arizal. The Ari HaKadosh says, when the Pasuk says that Yitzchak loved him, ki tzayid b'fiv, because tzayid, food was in his mouth. She'etzav hayalo nitzoshel kedusha b'tofiv. The tzayid b'fiv is a reference to Esav. He had kedusha, he had holiness in his mouth. She'kol ha'kedusha shel Esav hayta b'tofiv. It was inside his mouth. But shakadusha lo nesta chelak matzmiuto velo nivla'a l'toch gufo elaya rak mirasafa v'lachutz. The challenge was, where was the tzayid? Where was the kedusha? It was on his mouth. But he didn't allow it to be internalized. He didn't allow it to become part and parcel of who he was. It was only mirasafa v'lachutz on his mouth and outward. And this was the challenge that Esav had. Esav had to take the Kedusha, the holiness, and make it part and parcel of who he was. And that is where Esav fell. And it's interesting to note parenthetically in source 9 on the next page, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Drash Moshe, notes that we learned from our introductory pasuk that these are the children of Abraham who had Yitzchak, and Yitzchak who had these children, that in chinuch, in educating one's children, one cannot assume that modeling is enough. As important and as crucial as modeling is, a parent needs to be very much involved with their children. Just saying they're great parents and therefore the child would turn out great, there is no guarantee. We see from here that every parent has to invest in every child where they are at. This challenge of Esav, my friends, is really the challenge that all of us have in our life. As the Siach Yitzchak, Rosh Yeshiva, and Kol Yaakov explains in a new Sefer that just came out in Sefer Breishi. He notes in source number 11, Tshuvat HaRashpa, where the Rashpa said, V'klau kol ha-mitzvos talui b'shlosha dvarim. Our mitzvah observance is really dependent on three things. B'peh, our mouths, b'alev, our hearts, and b'yadayim, with our hands. Which means, the peh is the kli hara'ah, it's the medium of learning. It's the opening of chokhmah, of wisdom. But then we need to take that and turn it into v'yadata yom v'ashevel selvavecha. We need to turn it into something that is internalized in our heart. And then that alone is not enough. It then has to be transferred into the olam ha'maseh, into the world of action. And that's why you need to have almost the chachma, bina, and the das. The chachma is the knowledge. The bina is to be able to make it part of understanding that it's relevant, and the das becomes part and parcel of who one person is. The arrow in 11, l'kashera tadvarim im havanato ha'ishi, to make the learning as relevant and as personal as possible. L'aseit v'lateit b'hem b'tocho, to make it part of who we are. Lavin doch davar mitoch davar l'kayim, in order to achieve. And he notes in 12, you know, it's like a person who's shown a field, and the person can walk back and forth over and over again, thousands of times across the field. But if he doesn't do anything to acquire the field himself, the field isn't him. A person can sit and learn all the time, be involved in a lot of textual analysis. But if it doesn't become part of the person, if they don't internalize this knowledge, so then we fall into the trap of the Esav, where all it is the external knowledge that doesn't lead to changing who the person is. You know, working in the seminary system, I think this is one of the greatest challenges as a seminary teacher that we face with our students, where the students are involved in a year of intense learning, intense spiritual growth, intense experience of being with families who are very special, and tiyulim around Eretz Yisrael, and going different places. And it's a very powerful one-year experience. The challenge is to be able to take that experience and not just make it an experience, but make it part of who the person is. To make it the bina, the lifeblood of the person. That person thinks a different way, acts a different way, and is a different person. And that's why he notes in 13, when it says, "Vayhi Esav ish yodei hatzayid," that Esav was one who knew how to hunt. Shepei Weshuhu, which means Shaya b'mahuto b'vchinas peh. All he had was the peh, the mouth. He was satisfied with the knowledge that he gained, and he was somebody who sat in the yeshiva with Yaakov. He was a tremendous Talmid Chacham. Esav knew a tremendous amount, but his challenge was he didn't allow this to become part and parcel of himself. Very much like the personality of Lot, who could move to a city like stone. This is contrasted with Yaakov Avinu at the end of 13, where he has, Yaakov is described as Yoshev Oalim, who sits in the tents, plural. He sat in both the tent of shame as well as the tent of Aver. A person who wants to learn, a person who wants to grow, is going to go out, is going to search, and is not going to be satisfied with one. He's going to learn as many places as possible. He's going to try to grow from as many experiences as possible. This is the difference between an Esav, who the Targum translates as an Adam Batel, the Sadeh, it's a lazy, passive person, while Yaakov Avinu is somebody who desires to learn, who goes out to learn, and this is his personality because he wants to change, he wants to grow as a person. And this is perhaps an explanation in 17 that the Umshin of a Rebbe gives, the famous interchange between the Kutzker Rebbe and a student in 17, where a student comes in and says that he learned all of Shas. And the Kutzker Rebbe asked him, "Uma limedot chashas?" And what did the Shas teach you? It's very nice that that you learned all of Shas, but what did Shas teach you? And says the Amshin of a Rebbe, this is why. One of the reasons why we make a suda, a party, after finishing a masecha, after finishing learning. Because after you finish learning, you want to see, has the person changed at all? And one of the basic drives and desires of a person is food. How do you eat? How do you hold yourself in a meal? How do you hold yourself when you have delicious food in front of you? If you're able to eat like a Talmid Chacham, you're able to eat like a mensch, so then I see that the learning has become part and parcel of you. And if not, we see that maybe you've gone through the learning, but the learning hasn't gone through you. And this, my friends, is a challenge that we all have in our lives. How do we take what we know and make it part of us? That's that famous maisa, and I'm sure it's happened more than once, of an irate mother who calls up the school and says, can't the school be more careful about people's property and more sensitive about personal property? Her daughter went on a class trip and she lost her towel, and how could the school be so, you know, insensitive about other people's belongings? So the school personnel asked the mother, could you please describe the towel that was lost? The mother said, sure. It was a big white towel with Holiday Inn written across it. So obviously we see, my friends, that this is our challenge. And with this we understand, my friends, in 19, when Chazal tell us that Esav's head rolled and was buried in the Maris HaMachpelah, but his body was not. It makes sense now while Esav's head was buried in the Ma'ara, in the cave, because Esav's head represents a Talmid Chacham. Esav's head represents someone who knows a tremendous amount. The problem is, it stayed in his head. The problem is, it didn't become internalized. And I think, my friends, this is hinted at in the Pasuk when it speaks about in our section, that when Esav comes from the field, he says to Yaakov, Halitenina, I'll open up my mouth and all I want you to do is pour it in for me. That imagery where Esav doesn't even take the food into his mouth, where all he does is open up his mouth and wants someone else to pour it in, is the imagery of an individual who refuses to take an active part in making the learning his, to take an active part in making that learning infuse and be able to direct and channel and allow him to be influenced by what he learned. Just opening the mouth is the idea of Misafa V'Lachutz. And this, my friends, on the next page, is where we have to be careful in our own lives. As the Ramban points out in that famous letter of the Gerud HaRamban, he says in 21, take care to always study Torah diligently, so that you'll be able to fulfill its commands. When you rise from study, ponder carefully what you have learned. See what there is in it, which you can put into practice. The key, as the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos tells us in Source 22, is that the one who learns in order to teach will be enabled to learn and to teach. But the one who learns in order to practice will be enabled to learn and to teach, to observe and to practice. The goal ultimately of our learning is to see how we can change. The goal ultimately of the learning is not to add intellectual knowledge. Then now I know more information. Now I'm a little bit smarter. Now I'm a little bit wiser. Great. But what has that done for you? How has that changed you? After learning any piece, we have to ask ourselves, now what? Based on what I've learned, how can I now be able to take these ideas and bring them into my life? They say that the largest distance in the world is the distance from the head to the heart. The yadata hayom, the knowledge, to vashevel salvavecha, to be able to make this knowledge part and parcel of who we are. That's the challenge that we have in our lives. Obviously, getting up and seeing what we can do to implement is a first step. And we need to recognize and to know that Hadam Nifal Kifi Pulosav in 25, Rebbetzin Jung writes book, Life is a Test, that she quotes the idea of our rabbis that man is shaped by his deeds. Meaning, if you do something long enough, it becomes second nature, and it is that which makes you you. And therefore, my friends, oftentimes, there may be a halacha, there may be something that we say, it's just not me. If we do it, and we work on it, we've seen that ultimately, by doing it, Adam Nifal Kifi Pulosav, we become influenced by our actions. And it's important to get out there, and not just to know it up here, but to actually do. And in doing, we become a changed person. And sometimes we have to force ourselves at the beginning to be involved in the doing. And sometimes you're right, we feel like a hypocrite, this isn't me. But the more we do and the more we act, the more we become that individual. And Rebbetzin Jung writes, quotes a fantastic story written by a British author called The Happy Hypocrite. It's about a gentleman called Lord George, whose name mirrored his personality. His bad temper was reflected in his eyes, his face, his very demeanor, and good people tried to avoid him. Well, one day, Lord George fell madly in love with a sweet, gentle, lovely maiden. But she was so repelled by his appearance that she let him know that she could never entertain the thought of becoming involved with a man whose face was so cruel and angry. So Lord George came up with a brilliant idea. He would commission a master artist to create a mask for him that would reflect a kind, benevolent, gentle person. Thus disguised, he calls on the damsel who immediately fell in love with him. They were wed and lived happily ever after. Until one day an old enemy came to visit. You think you're married to a kind, gentle man? I'll show you who your husband really is, he said with glee. And with that, he ripped the mask off Lord George's face. But lo and behold, the face beneath the mask was identical to that of the mask. Throughout their marriage, Lord George had pretended to be gentle and generous, so his conduct would not belie his mask. This left deep marks on his mind and heart and transformed him into the person that he had pretended to be. My friends, this is the power of Ha'adam Nifal Kifi Puloso. How we are influenced by the way we act. And the more we act, the more it becomes part and parcel of who we are, the more we become changed. Therefore, for my friends, I think on the first level, the model of Esav for us is Kitzayid Vifiv. Esav's challenge, as Yorgadayahu noted, was to be able to take the negativity and to be able to sublimate it against the goodness and be able to mitake and rectify the sin of Adam. Esav allowed goodness to be only external. He didn't conquer it. He didn't allow goodness to become part and parcel of who he was, and he failed. Our challenge is to make it part and parcel of who we are. But then I think, my friends, there becomes a second dimension that is connected to this idea. We all know that there are three major parts of a person. In modern psychology, we call this the id, the ego, and the superego. In Torah terminology, we call this, in 28, the nefesh, the ruach, and the neshama. The nefesh is the life force, what we would call the id. The ruach would be the ego, the spirit, the internally oriented part of man, that's to feel, to think. And the neshama in 29, or supernal soul, it's linked with the transphysical realm of the creation, with the spiritual world and with God. It is the source of man's craving for relationship with God. And he notes that everyone is cognizant of his nefesh and his ruach. People are well aware of their physical needs. They're well aware of being, you know, their need for honor, their need for recognition, their ego. But not everyone is cognizant in the same natural way of his neshama. One's awareness of his neshama depends upon how great is his sensitivity to spiritual matters. And this sensitivity is a reflection of how much one has sanctified his life by removing materialistic strivings from it. If a person is a very base material person, you're taking away that sensitivity for the higher supernal soul to be felt within a person. And this explains in source number 32, and I think it's a phenomenon that many of us deal with. Esav was a great person, and I can't underscore this enough. He was a great Talmid Chacham, a great scholar, a great spiritual person. He, like many of us, had a she'ifa, a real ambition and desire for perfection, for wholeness. He wanted shleimus. We all have this desire that we could be as the best we can be. We all have dreams that we can be able to be successful in the different endeavors that we're involved with. But because Esav was such an externally oriented person, instead of being able to understand that this desire was really a spiritual desire, Esav translated this desire for shleimus, for wholeness, in very physical terms. And that's why when he sees this food, he says, I'm going to die unless I eat this. This is what I need to get shleimus. This is what I need to get perfection. He misunderstood that his desire for wholeness, his desire for perfection, which is really coming from a spiritual place, he felt could be replaced and could be supplemented by the physical desire of eating this food. And so many of us fall into this trap where we think that our physical desires is what's going to fill us. And we don't realize that these desires are coming from a spiritual place. And the only place that's really going to respond to these desires is a spiritual response. This aspect of thinking that the food will do it, and you know, if he has this food, everything will be okay, is really a reflection of the way Esav lived his life. On the Pasuk, Kitzayid Bifim, that he had this food in his mouth, Rashi tells us in 23 that he used it, Latsud Vilara, 33, Vilaramot et Aviv Bifim, he used it to fool his father with his mouth. He pretended to be very meticulous about mitzvos, and he really ensnared and entrapped his father with his mouth. And he said to his father, like, does salt or straw need to be meiser, need to be tied? And here he created an image of piety. His deception, 33b, of his father was revealingly concentrated in two specific details. The question of straw and salt, and it's not by accident. Salt is a subsidiary adjunct to food, and straw is a disposable external part of the wheat. It's precisely on these aspects that Esav's interest was centered, because Esav is involved in the superficial. Yaakov is involved in the internal. Esav is the model in 35 to hold on to the shell and let the fruit drop to the ground. This was the era of Esav. His interest was always in the appearance of things, and he didn't have the mindset to delve deeper. How could Esav be satisfied with thinking that the shleimus, perfection, could be food, when you live your life, an external life, to salt and straw need to be tied. Let's only look at the salt, the straw. Let's look at the outer coating of everything. Let's not go any deeper. When a person lives a life like this, it's no wonder that they think the outer things are going to fill them with personal satisfaction. It's no wonder in 37 where the Sichos Mussar tells us that later in Parshas Vayishlach, when Yaakov and Esav are wrestling, or the Sarosh al Esav, the archangel of Esav, and Yaakov at the end of the battle says, Hagida na li et shmecha, tell me your name. Hagida na shmecha, and the angel responds, Lama zet tishali shmi, why are you asking my name? So says the Sichos Mussar, that's his name, a name is an essence. Esav's name is, why are you asking my name? My name is. The angel of Esav was not posing a question, but rather giving reply. My strength, the end of 37, lies in the fact that people do not pause to examine me more closely to know my name, my essence. For if they would, it would dispel the illusion that I present. Thus the angel of Esav truly answered Yaakov's question as to his name. That's what Esav represents, the superficiality. And that's why Esav describes the food not as Nzira Dashim, not as lentils, but Ha'adom Ha'adom Hazeh, and in fact his name becomes Edom, becomes red based on this. For this reason, the asterisk in 36, the Madrigatic Adam explains his name after his reaction to the incident of the red lentil. Edom red, he is called as an everlasting reminder of his automatic response. It's an indication of his true nature. He's dazzled by the immediate aspect of things. His energies are concentrated on inner satisfaction and pleasure. And the Siach Yitzchak in 38 notes that the color red is a very powerful color. It's a color that is something that draws a person. It's a representation of, let me just look on the outside. Let me be dazzled by what the way it looks like. But it's not to go any deeper than that. My friends, we live in the galus of Edom. We live under this mindset in our lives. All of us are affected by the world we live in is a very external-oriented world. The way things look is the way we judge things. And we are told that if you would get this product or that product, it's going to fulfill all the needs that you have. And we don't go deeper very often. And we buy this product and we buy that product. And we think that with these products, we will fill ourselves. And you and I both know that the more we buy and the more we buy, aside from the effect it has on our pocketbook, the emptier we get, the emptier we get, the more we're longing for more and more, and the more we try to fill it. And the mindset of Edom, of the Western civilization, says, we'll try this product and then try that product. And it ups the ante each time. But each time we're left feeling emptier and emptier. We all know that one of the best things that little children can play with is pots and pans and a wooden spoon. To get all these toys that have, you know, every time you press a button, there's another noise. What you're doing is upping the ante. And now what? How many times do we buy these sophisticated games for our kids? They're excited for a week, and then it's sitting on board. Buy me something that's the newest and latest and greatest and greatest. We're perpetuating this. Many of us live our lives, and we're aware of it, that our lives are searching for meaning. We want something deep. We want something meaningful. But we fall into the trap of Esav. We're satisfied with the Adom Adom Hazeh. If I eat this food, if I'm taken in by this red color, and I'm taken in by the way this looks, this is going to respond to my deep spiritual desire. But it doesn't. It doesn't at all. And Esav remains in Esav. And Yaakov remains the one who's truly happy, who's truly feeling the fulfillment both in this world as in the next world, because he's involved in spiritual pleasures. And my friends, you can ask yourself this question. Think about a time that you went, maybe as a child, you took your children to, let's say, great adventures. And there's nothing wrong with going on these rides and having a great time. But think about it. Afterwards, okay, you may have felt dizzy and sick and many other things. But let's say your children were, you know, really into it. And they said, wow, that was a great time. A week from now, the thrill is gone. It's empty. Now think about a time where you did a chesed for somebody. And even children can think about this, where they helped a friend out. They visited somebody who was sick. Whatever it may be, something that was very special, where you really felt that you made a difference. My friends, I'll tell you, I can promise you this. Years later, you can go back to that experience and still be filled with those warm feelings of giving, of changing a person's life, of making something meaningful. So there's nothing wrong with thrill and with having a good time, as long as we understand how limiting it is. And to ask ourselves, if I'm looking for meaning, is this the place that I'm going to find meaning? Where is the meaning going to be found in my life? 4 hours in front of a TV set? Okay, we all need downtime. Or are there other ways to have downtime that can be able to give something to the world around us? As Rabbi Twersky speaks about on Twersky and Spirituality on 43, Western civilization has a concept of fun. An analysis of fun reveals it often to be an activity which accomplishes nothing tangible. In fact, if someone asks why he's doing something and he responds for the fun of it, it means that the activity does not result in any useful product or service. The Adom Hadom Hazem, this red, the lentils, that very powerful color that draws a person in, but then you sell your birthright, you sell your soul for nothing, for an empty, fleeting experience. So if the first idea we learned from Esav is he had a lot of intellectual knowledge, but he didn't internalize it, this leads to a slippery slope where the person who's going to be involved just in the external is going to be more aware of their nefesh and the ruach, their id and the ego, and not so much the superego, not so much their neshama. And therefore, when they have a craving to become whole, when they have a spiritual craving to be doing something meaningful and purposeful in this world, they're going to translate it as an id or an ego response. They're going to fill it by eating. They're going to fill it by doing something just to kill time and for the fun of it. But ultimately, they walk out, okay, a little bit heavier, a little bit, but they walk out much emptier, really, much emptier, and they're still looking, and they're still filling, and they're still looking. One who's able to understand the lesson of Esav says, let me not get caught in this hadom, hadom hazeh, in this red thing. Let me look beyond. Let me delve deeper. Let me understand. Let me see what the purpose of life is. Let me see how I can utilize my talent, my time, who I am, to make the best person of myself, my family, and the world around me. That's greatness. That's the Yaakov Avinu. Okay. So we all suffer from Esav here and there. What makes Esav so terrible? Well, why do Chazal describe him as Esav HaRasha, Esav the wicked one? What is going on here? So I'd like to end with a final piece from Rav Wolfson in an essay in Wellsprings of Faith that I'd just like to distill down in the last two pages. The pasuk tells us, Vayigdalu ha-narim, the boys grew up, and one went out into the fields, and one went into the Olei Torah, into the houses of Torah. Now, obviously, Rashi says, it's 13, other commentators note it's 15. There's something that must have happened that was dramatic, that suddenly their personalities came out into the open. You mean to tell me for 15 years, Esav was able to hide who he was? It seems hard to understand. Suddenly, Esav is this bad Esav, and Yaakov is this great tzaddik, Talmid Chacham. There must have been a major transformation that went on. And in fact, in 45, while Yaakov was cooking the lentils, Esav came back from the field, ayef, weary, and fainting. And we know Yaakov's making the lentils because that's the food we make for a mourner. Avraham Avinu had just died that day, and he's making this food for his father, something round. A mourner doesn't have a mouth, right? Today, people give usually eggs. Why was Esav so weary? What had he been doing? So Esav's weariness had a spiritual cause. His soul was weak and faint because he had just committed the sin of murder. 46, the Medrash reports that Esav had killed Nimrod in order to steal a precious set of clothing from him. These were garments with rare spiritual properties that Hashem himself had made for Adam Rishon. And Esav covered them that would help him trap animals, and he took these garments, and therefore when he returned home, his hands were bloody and his soul weak. He was confronted with the news that his grandfather Abraham had just passed away. And we know the rabbis have said that he committed 5 sins on this particular day, including which denying the resurrection, I'm about to die, and doing horrible things. And again, we ask ourselves, you know, almost like something flipped in him. What happened? So there are 2 things that we need to keep in mind, says Rav Wolfson, in order to be able to explain this question, and I think also see a lesson for our lives as well. The first idea, he notes, is in 48. As each day is completed, it goes up to heaven, where it continues to exist on a higher level. During a person's lifetime, however, his days are separated from him by a great distance, and their effect on him is weak and indirect. Right? If I were to ask you, where were you 3 years ago and 4 months? So you'll say to me, I don't remember what happened 3 years ago. Some people of us will say, I don't remember what happened yesterday, let alone this morning. Yeah? Like, we don't remember these things. So each day is its own entity. It goes up to Shemayim, and there is where it sits and waits. But my friends, this all changed suddenly and dramatically on the last day of a person's life. A short-term time before a person leaves the world, all the days of his life return to him. According to the Zohar, they come back in order to welcome him and to escort him upward to his place in the spiritual world. What a thought to think about. Each and every mitzvah, each and every day, you can imagine what it must look like, that final glorious day. And they take their place in 49 in suddenly expanded present, a time without boundaries that is nearly impossible for us to imagine. It's as if the last day of a person's life stretches to include within itself all the previous days of his life. On a tzaddik, this day is the greatest day of his life. All the spiritual energy of his entire life comes back to him on this day. Perhaps the most famous model for us would be the Rashbi, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, with a fire surrounded his house on his last day, and he gave over the secrets of Torah because that was the day where he was greater than all of the other days. It's the day in 50 that Moshe Rabbeinu is described as an Ish Elokim, a man of God, because in his last day, all of the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu's days came to greet him, to bring him to his final resting place. The second idea we need to know before putting this all together is that Kadosh Baruch Hu creates in this world a principle called equilibrium, that if one generation there's a great tzaddik, he'll be opposed by a great rasha in the same generation. If the tzaddik, the righteous person, is on a lower level, then the rasha, the wicked person, is on a lower level. Zeh l'umat zeh, everything has a balance. The tzaddik is locked in a fierce, protracted struggle against an arch enemy, a Russia whose strength and determination are comparable to his own. Whatever the tzaddik tries to accomplish in this world, the Russia tries to destroy, for the goals of the tzaddik and the Russia are diametrically opposed. In the time of Yaakov Avinu, we understand why Esav is buried the same day as Yaakov, zeh l'umat zeh, one against the other. When Avraham Avinu was around, there was one great Russia who was as great as the Sitkus, as the greatness of Avraham Avinu, and that was Nimrod. Nimrod's name means merit, means to rebel. While Avraham Avinu went out to proclaim the greatness of God, Nimrod, according to many, was the one that threw Avraham Avinu into the fiery furnace, went out to teach people not to believe in one God, and that was his whole mission. So Abraham and Nimrod were arch enemies face to face in this world. The greatness of Avraham Avinu was matched by the rishus of Nimrod, was mirrored by that imagery. Now, we can appreciate all of what's going on. Let's put it all together on the last page, 56. You can imagine that Avraham Avinu's last day, how he had Yaakov Avinu, who was his disciple, who came to visit him, to learn Torah from him, to get a blessing from him, and that Yaakov Avinu was present at the bedside when Avraham Avinu died. And you can imagine Avraham Avinu's last day, 175 Baba Yamin, luminous, perfected days, filled with mitzvos, filled with light, filled, if you want to call it, with positive energy and angels are coming to escort him. In such an atmosphere, the asterisk in 56 of Kedusha, of holiness, a sensitive person, an individual attuned to holiness, would have been able to absorb a tremendous amount of holiness. Such a person would have received a great spiritual gift. Yaakov's soul was filled with a tremendous gift of his grandfather's holiness, and he became a profound tzaddik. At that moment, when Avraham Avinu dies, and all of this spiritual energy is found in the room, Yaakov Avinu, who has a propensity towards spirituality, is able to take all of this spirituality in, vayigdalu on the Arim. Not only he grew up, he became great. V'akatan gadol yeyeh, we say it at Bris. He was great. He was awesome. He then suddenly had like an electric charge, a trampoline effect, where he grew immensely in this spiritual environment of being at Avraham Avinu's bedside. The Chasam Sofer, in fact, says that if he was by his Rebbe, Rav Nosson Adler's bedside when he had died, he would become much greater than he was. This was a powerful experience that Yaakov Avinu took in. Now, let's contrast that, right? Meanwhile, back at the ranch, back in the field, 57. And where was Esav at that moment? He was in a different place completely. This was the day of Esav's murder encounter with Nimrod. And that would make sense. Why didn't Nimrod have to die on this day? Because if Avraham Avinu was going to die on this day, so Nimrod, the arch enemy, was also going to have to die. But it was Esav who decided to kill him. And you can imagine that when Esav stripped Nimrod's gruesome corpse of the garment he so desperately coveted, and he took from himself, not only did he get those coveted garments, but the impurity, the asterisk in 57, which entered Esav's soul at that moment, was not only a result of the sin of murder for the dead body that lay before Esav, because it was no ordinary corpse. Nimrod had been the most wicked man of his generation, and the evil that he had committed during his lifetime caused his body and death to be an intensely powerful source of tumah. You can almost imagine in 58, the thousands upon thousands of destructive angels that gathered about all the hideous creatures that had been created by his foul crimes. In such an atmosphere of spiritual degradation and pollution, in such a place of uncleanliness, what kind of person would be liable to suffer the greatest spiritual damage? What kind of soul would draw the tumor to itself as a magnet attracts iron fillings? Precisely a person who already set upon the path of evil, someone like Esav. For there's a general rule that holiness and unholiness are each attracted to their own kind. A soul filled with holiness will draw itself to any nearby sparks of holiness, and a soul sullied by tuma will be especially vulnerable to any unclean influences by the environment. And now we can understand why when Esav comes back from the field, he is a totally different person than when before he killed Nimrod. Just like Yaakov was a totally different person than before Avraham Avinu died. This was a pivotal day where Yaakov and Avinu were able to take in all the positive energy forces, and Esav took in all the negative energy forces. And therefore, Esav rejected everything out of hand almost suddenly, because he was no longer just Esav. He was Esav squared by many, many hundredfold, because he took in all that negativity by killing Nimrod, countered by all the positivity that Yaakov took in by being at the side of Abraham when he left this world. Now, though, my friends, many of us, thank God, do not have the opportunity of being with people who leave this world, I think the lesson that we can learn finally for our lives from this, I think, is equally important. And that is to understand that the environment which we put ourselves in has certain spiritual forces. And a person of spiritual orientation will be pulled by those spiritual forces, and the opposite as well. And I'd like to close as our final idea, and then Emir Tzashem summarize with the Michtam Eliyahu Rav Dessler 61a. He says, "Im adam mitkarev el sviva sheina chazaka kolkach bavodat Hashem." If a person is in an environment which is not strong in the service of God, even if his kavanos are the best intentions, Nevertheless, by moving to such a place, he recognizes within himself that he is going to have to compromise on certain areas. And this compromise does not only affect him, it affects his family as well. And likewise, if a person decides to put himself in a very positive environment, even if he's not holding there, he makes a statement for himself and his family. And my friends, I think it doesn't only apply to the environment and the community we live in. I think obviously it applies as well to the type of friends that we have. And this is the question that we have to ask ourselves. In the lives that we lead, when I look around at my friends, I need to ask myself, are these friends friends that bring me up spiritually? Are these friends that make me a better person? Are these friends that are going to make me think about how I can fill that spiritual desire that I have to become even a greater person? And they encourage my spiritual growth, and they recognize my desires, and they're with me on that, right? They come with me every Sunday morning when I schlep them along, and they do it with a happy face. Or do I have friends that mimic, that mock, that ridicule, that have friends who are a little bit more lax in Lashon Hara and bring me down as well? We see so clearly from this model of Esav how important the environment around us is, that it has an influence on us whether we're even aware of it or not. That they're almost like these spiritual forces, well, perhaps most dramatic at the time of a person leaving this world. But while a person is alive, a tzaddik has, a righteous person, a righteous community, righteous friend, have a certain positive energy that will create positivity within us. And the opposite is true as well. And I think that's the final lesson to learn for Esav in our lives as well, is what surroundings do we put ourselves in? And therefore, my friends, in summation, what we saw today is that there is a tremendous amount we can learn from Esav and Esav's message for our lives. The first is intellectual is very important, but make sure the intellectual is transferred down into the practical. It's not enough for Esav's head to be buried in Maris HaMachpelah. Where is his body? Has he been able to take it into who he is, to act that eventually when we do, our face and the mask will be one and the same? The second is to recognize that all of us have these spiritual cravings. Some of us think it's craving for food, and we misunderstand it, that it's really a spiritual craving to be able to accomplish, to do, to fill ourselves up. If we're spiritually connected, okay, we still have craving for chocolate, even spiritually connected, but we understand that these cravings are really for a much deeper thing. People who live a very, very external life, a life who's into the Adom Hadom Hazeh, so the red catches their attention, and the latest and greatest, and we put our energies in these latest and greatest toys, and they're sophisticated toys, and sophisticated fashion, and they're sophisticated means of entertainment, whatever they may be. But they're not responding to the neshama, to the soul, that asks for a deeper question. So that when a student asks me, Mrs. Smiles, is it okay for me to jump from an airplane for the thrill of it? This is a person who's looking for meaning in life and is so misplaced on what this meaning is all about. My kids were even horrified when I told her, go ahead and do it. She didn't, but she needed to hear her to go ahead and do it. But that's a separate story. And the third and final level is that we have to be ready to understand that Esav's whole personality changed because of this experience of killing Nimrod. Yaakov's whole personality changed because of his experience by being by Avraham Avinu. We have to be so careful about the environment we put ourselves in, the spiritual energy that we find surrounding us, as well as in our own private life, to see what is it that brings us, in terms of our friends and the spheres of influence that we have. Just like to conclude on a personal level, that I'd like to welcome last week and this week Hollywood, Florida, which has joined us as a trial run in these shiurim. So we welcome another city in Florida as well. I'd also like to respond to a call from Philadelphia last week that asked for recommendations about listening. So I had recommended to the caller, to this woman, an excellent book called The Lost Art of Listening which is an excellent book on how we've lost the art of listening. But in particular, when one's talking about listening to one's children, perhaps the classic book out there is How to Talk So Kids Could Listen, How to Listen So Kids Could Talk, something along those lines, a very famous book. That perhaps is the classic parenting book and model in that particular way. And finally, if anyone else has any ha'aras or any thoughts or comments about these shiurim, we welcome all thoughts and comments. You can call us at 323-908-3962 or email us at ffs4smiles@gmail.com.